Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education. I'm so glad you're here tonight. Tuesday Evenings, for those of you who don't know, is a weekly lecture series. It started a couple of weeks ago, and it runs through November 18th this fall. Then it'll start up again in February. So I suggest you get online and check the schedule, see which ones you can't afford to miss. Next week, we have James Cutler, FAIA, founding partner of Cutler Anderson Architects, and he's here to present Searching for True. He's going to talk about Cutler and Anderson Architects and his philosophy on the significance of architecture in relationship to nature, and that's just very general. He'll go into that much more deeply. He's here in conjunction with the Fort Worth AIA jury competition that happens every year, and he's the lead juror for that competition. So I hope you can come back next week. Tonight, I am so happy to have Jenny Jaske, director and curator of the Artist Institute at Hunter College, here to give us insights into the work of the Artist Institute. And as mentioned in the description that I think many of you probably read of tonight's lecture, she's here to discuss the importance of time for curatorial practice today, how durational modes of engagement can provoke new ways of seeing and being with art. So she immediately won me over with that line. The Artist Institute, which has been on Eldridge Street in the Bowery. That's where I first encountered it just last year. It's a new find, and I'm very excited about it. But it is moving to the Upper East Side, so they're kind of in a moment of hiatus as they're making that move. The Artist Institute is a research institute and an experimental curatorial platform for contemporary art in New York City. The Institute dedicates every 6 months of programs to a single artist. So be sure you're catching this. I think this is fascinating. So a single artist every 6 months whose work becomes the occasion for a series of exhibitions, public programs, and private discussions with leading contemporary thinkers from a variety of disciplines. At the center of its approach is a commitment to education, believing that art deserves sustained attention and makes important contributions to intellectual life. Jenny Jaske, as director and curator, knows this unique programming well. It's hers. Because of this, she works very closely for extended periods of time with artists including Haim Steinbeck, Lucy McKenzie, and most recently, Pierre Huig. The upcoming exhibition in winter 2015, which will be in their new space, is with Carolee Schneeman. In addition, Jenny has curated other exhibitions with recent ones including The Ends of the Library and Serving the Library at the Goethe Institute in New York in 2012-2013. And Yuda Kader, Mad Garland at the Center of Curatorial Studies of Bard College in 2012. She is also co-editor with Christopher Cox and Suhail Malik of Realism, Materialism, Art, which is a publication on the speculative turn in philosophy and aesthetics published by Steinberg Press, something I'm looking forward to finding out more about. Jenny's credentials and interest intrigue me, and I'm fascinated by the Artist Institute's programming. There is so much value in reconsidering how and why we look at art, in restructuring or at least extending the institution's engagement with the artist, as well as enriching the artist's relationship with the institution. This seems timely and pertinent, as there are so many independent new curatorial efforts in this area, and many seem to be wanting something more. So that is the impetus for my invitation to Jenny. I'm very thankful she accepted. So without further delay, please join me in welcoming Jenny Jaske.
Thank you. Good evening, and having grown up in the South myself, hey y'all. Before beginning, I want to extend my sincere thanks to Terry and to the staff here at the Modern, including Michael Moore and John Knuckles, who have made this event possible, and I really appreciate their help. So tonight I'm going to speak about the Artist Institute, an experimental gallery and research institute that I direct in New York City, And it's an exciting time to be doing so. As Terry was mentioning, we're at the beginning of our fifth year of operation, and this fall we're in an important incubation period when we're evaluating our mission, our past programming, and what kind of organism we want to become. And I use words like incubation and organism here because I find these biological metaphors productive for thinking about the way that institutions function and grow, being made up of diverse and interconnected bodies whose collective intelligence develops over time. How an institution can be generative. This is a really key word for me, especially coming out of Pierre's season. And how it can be generative, especially for artists, is a question that drives my curatorial work and is the basis for the questions I'm asking myself now as the Institute looks to the future. So we have to start with an egg. So I start with the egg, and this was on the floor of briefly this spring. During our six-month season, we call them seasons, not exhibitions, for a reason that will become apparent soon. So we had a six-month season with the artist Pierre Wieg, and the egg is how I see the Artists Institute now. In that speculative moment before the hatch, when what can be is an open question, which is something that Pierre thinks a lot about. I always am learning from the artists. It's an open question, and we await the next opening in 2015 when we're on the Upper East Side. So in order to understand where we are now, though, I want to go back a bit to the beginning of the Artists Institute story and how we find ourselves with this particular egg. Okay. So, the Artists Institute story begins in 2010, or a little before then. It opened in 2010, when the director of the Hunter College Art Galleries invited a curator named Anthony Huberman. Some of you may know Anthony. He's now the director of the Wattis Institute in San Francisco. He just began that a year ago. He left for San Francisco. So the director of the galleries came to Anthony and said, "Here are our galleries. Would you like to be the curator of our galleries, white box galleries?" And I believe the invitation was ostensibly to do something that we might all understand, which would be 4 to 6 artists per year, perhaps having a solo show, a group show on a relevant theoretical or curatorial or artistic topic, some discursive presentations as a complement to the exhibitions, and these kinds of programs. And I'm not trying to be sarcastic. They're wonderful, but they're everywhere. We kind of know them. We know them from places called the Institute of Contemporary Art or Contemporary Art Center or any number of university galleries. And that was a perfectly reasonable invitation. But in 2009 and 2010, around this time, many curators, and especially those working in the European context, were beginning to ask themselves questions about if the art world needed more of these kinds of exhibitions, which were starting... And they were starting to wonder what possibilities existed for art. What about it could we open up if curators began to cultivate new contexts for it? These contexts are very similar. So is the art. This was a time when new institutionalism of the early aughts, a kind of thinking about the curatorial, as Ira Rogoff calls it, was reaching maturity. So people like Maria Hlavajova at Bach in Amsterdam, or Maria Lind, who's now at Tensta Kunsthalle, or Thomas Buto of Castillo Corrales, or Charles Esch at the Van Abbe Museum, these kinds of thinkers were trying to think about how they could serve artists by reimagining, often through discursive formats, the context of the work's reception. And in 2010 in New York, when the Artists Institute was being formulated, or when this invitation to do a university gallery appeared, we could understand this, and now we really understand this. I searched Contemporary Art Daily in Google and just took a screenshot. And we understand this, don't we? Hundreds of emails from Eflux with many shows that we can never see and stress us out to try to see them. And there are 350 galleries in Chelsea in New York. And there are more galleries in the Lower East Side, and now galleries are moving out of the Lower East Side because there's too many galleries in the Lower East Side. They're looking for the next cool place to go. And at the art school at Hunter, where this gallery could be, there's 150 MFA students at any given time, 150 that graduate every 3 years. So we might say that the great art conveyor belt was humming along very well, and it is picking up the pace for sure today. And it's no surprise that terms like accelerationism or the attention economy are words that we're becoming very familiar with in what we're reading in popular culture and in philosophy and in the latest Eflux journal. And so the art conveyor belt never feels more relevant, I think, now. I'm not trying to be negative here, but I think this is the stage that the Arts Institute's kind of being formed under. And there's a rhythm. There's a rhythm to the art world that still feels familiar, and that rhythm we can kind of see here. 6-week gallery shows. An artist works 2 years for their 6-week gallery show. 3-month museum shows. Daily updates. A pace that can feel like channel surfing, multitasking, and looking for what's next in the RSS feed. And there's a curator, actually, whose maxim is well known. Don't stop, don't stop, don't stop. And that could easily be the lyrics to the art world tempo I'm describing. A certain kind of frenetic, Adderall-induced lifestyle organized around being everywhere and with everything, but perhaps leaving without having ever actually seen anything at all. And so the Artist Institute began because it wanted to reconsider the context for being with art in New York. And it wanted to stop, slow down, spend time with art at an intimate scale. And so this was the idea, which is like a pretty simple one, but actually it's kind of revolutionary whenever you work within it. It really changed the way that I curate and how I think about artists. So six months, one artist. This is what we do. This is our tempo. And this is our space, which is getting a bit bigger, but just a little fancier. But, you know, this is us. So we're basement, Lower East Side, and let's see. We show one work at a time. Sometimes when you're working with Pierre Weig, there's no such thing as one work at a time. But there's one work at a time. Here's an early season of the Artist Institute. This is Joe Baer. And then we go where the work leads, which, in the case of Joe Baer, led to us needing to have an orchid sale on Saturday, because Joe is very interested in orchids, and they relate to her work. And then we also think with art, not just about art, which meant then that we had to invite Nick Gambaroff and Air Akawa to put up these paintings with Joe Baer's painting, because this is a way of thinking with her painting. And it connects us to what young artists are doing today who are living on the Lower East Side. And then we thought, well, we don't have to just think. I mean, we're at a university, so shouldn't we as curators be thinking with the people who are thinking about art? And so we have a graduate seminar that was another idea of the Artist Institute, where we have, and this is very unusual to Hunter, it's been really wonderful. We have half artists and half art historians who take all of the graduate classes at Hunter. And so that's what this class is. So this is kind of a diagram of how the Artists Institute began and its thinking. It was like, okay, we have an artist whose thinking is going to feed our curatorial research and graduate seminar. We're going to learn about them, but we're going to learn beside them and with them, and we're going to think about them as we're walking around New York in 2014 with our questions. And then what the artist is doing is going to lead us, as we're thinking about their work, to like a lot of other things, because that's what ideas do. They generate more ideas. And so then all of these beside the artist moments happen over time. So our 6 months graduate seminar. Okay, so then these were our artists. This is all the artists we worked with for the last 4 years. Eight artists. And there they are. And so the Institute quickly became known as a place that is experimental, nimble, asking questions about the artist's work as time progressed and developing its program without a clear end destination in mind. This was a really important thing for us in terms of thinking about education and how we all learn. We learn as we go through time, and we don't know where we're going, but we're following the work. And so this is, I'm going to show you some pictures from what we've done. This is Rosemary Trockel. Rosemary took our one work at a time thing very seriously and just showed one thing on the back of the gallery, but would not allow us to show anything else besides her work for the entire 6 months in terms of other objects in the room, which ended up being very powerful. But other artists were okay with us having other artwork in the room. And this is from Jimmy Durham's season. This is a performance by a composer called David Grubbs, and it's a concert with Stones. And then also for Jimmy Durham's season, then our thinking led to, Carolyn Christoph Bakarkiev is working on Documenta, and Jimmy Durham is really influential to her thinking, and especially what he's thinking about apple trees. So we had Carolyn come and talk about Jimmy's love for apple trees. And then the students, they spent the 6 months thinking about Jimmy Durham, and some of them didn't even know who Jimmy Durham was before the beginning of the semester. But they're getting to know Jimmy, and he's Skyping with them from Italy because he refuses to come into the United States. Actually, he refuses to recognize it. And so they thought, well, this is great. Let's do a dinner of foraged food that has half indigenous and half non-indigenous plants. This is a lot like how Jimmy Durham thinks. And so they had this dinner at the Artists Institute. And then sometimes we have the pleasure of having the artist with us, which is really wonderful when it happens. And this is Thomas Beile, and he came, I guess, a year and a half ago. And he's sitting with a student of his. His entire season, every artist, the way we curate is just different for everyone. And Thomas wanted his whole season to be about him, his students, and his collaborators. He was uncomfortable with being a single artist. He doesn't believe in that. And then this is a season I curated with Chaim Steinbeck, who I think has had a nice show here in Texas recently. And this is an example of how we would, in thinking about an artist's work, then be led to a much younger contemporary artist. In this case, the video work in the back is by someone named A.K. Burns. And Chaim and I were really trying to think about how, you know, a term that's gotten used with his work a lot is like commodity, and he hates that. And so we thought, let's just think about touch and that tactile, haptic desire that your shelves evoke in us. And so we paired that with a work by AK that was dealing actually with object fetishes on YouTube. And then this was an exciting moment for me, and I think this has really begun to feed where I can see the Institute going in the future and how it can keep being generative for artists. So Chaim, when we were talking, his favorite work that he has ever made is 1979 display number 7A for Artist Space in New York. It was his first show in New York. And He always shows that image. It's the first one in all of his catalogs, the first one on the Tanya Ben-Akhtar website. And we thought, let's try to reimagine that now so that you can revisit that memory. And as you might see that in 2012, this was in the fall of 2012. And so he did. So he reimagined this display, number 7A. And then this way of him building this wall, if you've seen any of the shows he's done more recently at the Kunsthalle Zurich and the Serpentine and the Hessel Museum, and he's used this. So we really became an incubator for this way of him, this way for him to think and to try something out in like our basement. And this is Lucy McKenzie, who was the artist last fall. Lucy has also been an inspiration for A Way Forward. She lives in Brussels and decided to move to New York City for the entire 6 months that she was going to be with us in our basement. And she had just finished a solo show at the Stedelijk Museum where she had made these massive paintings of based on the Alhambra Palace. And then she took the same stencils that she had used for those paintings and just did an entire wall painting in our basement, exactly like them, and wanted to play with ephemerality and kind of status of the image. And so these were new commissions and ways that I thought were like, we truly were becoming an incubator for how an artist could think about making work without the same kind of display pressures and truly the same kind of quote-unquote general audience that they might normally have. I mean, Lucy has a show coming up at the Art Institute of Chicago, and Pierre is going to be at LACMA, and this is like a different way for them to work. Okay, so then returning to our initial diagram. Let me find myself here. So this is how I started thinking about it. because I thought, it's true that the artist does lead us to all these other things and we can make these connections, and that's really interesting. But it's also super interesting that then those connections can feed back into the artist and what they want to do next. And we can actually, they can be learning at our Artist Institute at just at the same time that we're learning about what it is that they care about. And then extending actually beyond like the things we would normally think about here in the art world, nice things like philosophy and poetry, and those are great. But what about genetic engineering and working with economists or working with labor activists or scientists, technologists? Those things became really interesting touchstones for a number of artists that we worked with. So here, I love these pictures because you can really like see illustrated what I'm talking about. So Haim's obsessed with the word object, and Levi Bryant, who's a contemporary philosopher who lives here in Texas, writes about object-oriented ontology. And Haim, I gave him a book, and he was very interested in it. And so we invited Levi to come to New York to give a talk. And Haim is like the person we had in mind for that talk. But our audience got to know a lot more about Haim's way of thinking, and the artists in the room who were interested in Levi could also get to hear what he had to say. So we end up, I think, also feeding artists who with ideas that might even be attracted to Haim's work, and then they end up being really attracted to a lot of the things he researches, and I feel like we can kind of grow more art through the process. For here, you can see Lucy's on the left, and this is Penny Martin, the editor of a fashion magazine called The Gentlewoman from London. And Lucy has a fashion line. I became a shop girl. We had a boutique of her clothes for one of our exhibitions. And then we had the son of Carl Sagan, Dorian Sagan, came to talk about bacteria and how they make up our bodies for Rosemary Trockel. That's her play on Courbet's Origin of the World in the photograph. And so commissioning really became at our scale, because we're not at the scale of display and jazz hands and general publics. We're really at the scale of like your living room, maybe like actually we're at the scale of 1/4 of the state. And so it really, commissioning became this mutual learning process. This is very new. Our first artist was not a lot, he's a dead artist. So this was not at all how we began thinking about this, but it's something that became apparent, like was a strength. So Lucy McKenzie, who is a woman with very broad interests, also was interested in becoming a detective writer, a writer of crime fiction. So when she was in New York, she was attending the New York Crime Fiction Academy, and she wrote this book, Unlawful Assembly. The cover image is by Josephine Pride. It's a funny image. And so we had one of the leading experts on the writings of Muriel Spark, who was a Scottish novelist that Lucy really likes, come and speak about stylish spinsters. Lucy's obsessed with old women. And then after this period of a few months of this learning, then Lucy made a new film based on Miss Marple by Agatha Christie, and it was shot by Richard Kern. So this was our very first, really, I guess, really big commissioned work as the Artists Institute was a film with Lucy. And then for Pierre's season, Pierre does extensive research with many kinds of crazy scientists and anthropologists and archaeologists, especially as he's been working and his work has been moving more into geologic material and biological material. And so we had Angelique Courtals, who wrote her PhD on this man called the Copper Man. It was a mummy that died in the Chincomata copper mine in Chile. And it's something that Pierre was hoping to, a process actually that Pierre was hoping to replicate maybe in future work. So as Pierre and I were thinking about his season, we thought, we have no pressure to try to like put on the show that you're going to do at Marion Goodman Gallery. We can do what you want to do in your studio. So we invited Angelique to come and tell him that. And then this is like a picture that he took that's part of his research at this same desert place in Chile. So there's some. It'll be really exciting to see if you go to our website and listen to any of these talks that, especially for his season that I've had, they're like little clues for things that in a year or two or three, you'll be like, oh, I know why they had the guy come talk about how you genetically engineer rats. And then intimacy. So this is really important. And maybe you all are better at it, not in New York. We're not very good at intimacy in New York. We're very good at congregating at like many, many things, loud places where we can't really talk. And we just want to be seen somewhere at an opening of the many openings we go to in 1 week. But this is really important, and it's really missing. And it also seems like a strength of the Artists Institute's way of working going forward. So we have to be intimate because we're very small. Mm-hmm. And the people that speak sometimes attract a lot of people, and then they have to, like, hang it in. But this is an event, like, for instance, this is what it looks like. So it's intimate. Very hot in the summer. But we've also extended that intimacy that's maybe not always like planned to being a really planned kind of intimacy. So this is an opening at the Artists Institute. We don't always do this, and to be honest, we don't really have that many openings. People just come. And for this opening, we allowed our people, like the people on our mailing list, we said, just email us if you want to come to our opening. We're only going to have spaces for 15, though. And so then they wrote us. And then the first 15 could come. And the opening was just a room with 15 chairs in front of this artwork by Chaim Steinbeck from 1986. And then everyone sat down, and someone stood up and said, "Can everyone see?" And then sat back down. And we sat in front of the artwork for 1 hour. And eventually people talked about the artwork sitting at it, watching it. And I think that was, we've done this a couple times, and every time it's just really special. Because you never realize at openings, you never really get to see the art, in fact. And you never really get to talk to people about what they think about it. And then we did something extreme, which was for Pierre's opening. Pierre's very into this idea right now of the witness. And he's really into the idea that sometimes an artwork only needs to be for one person who can witness it. And actually, maybe it's not even an artwork. He's very funny about that term. And so we had an opening for his season, which was just a person dancing in a glow-in-the-dark dress for one other person. And it wasn't announced. I mean, we had something the next night where people came and they thought it was the opening, but it was like not the opening. And so we're not afraid to do stuff like that too. And so thinking about openings, so this was also, I'm just finishing Pierre, so I'm like obsessed with the season. But this is the birth that happened of this little bird. We had a hatch day. Pierre and I thought, if this whole season is about being generative, then we should have an egg for sure. And it can open, and that will be another opening for the season. We had a lot of openings, just kept opening. And so this little bird was born on the floor of the Arts Institute, and I'm very glad to say that it lived. I wasn't sure about taking it out of the incubator. So this is what I think the Arts Institute's potential is. And then this is where we're going, which is this townhouse. So the Artist Institute is a part of Hunter College, and Hunter College got gifted this beautiful house uptown. It's like next to where Richard Nixon used to live. It's a very fancy part of town. And we're being given the first floor, which the architect last week, still on his plan, said it's technically the basement, which we were very happy about. So we'll still be on the basement, but it will be a little bigger. I think we have 3 rooms now, and we move from 500 square feet to like 1,200 square feet, which will be really exciting. And this becomes another question for me in thinking about the Artist Institute, which is a really pressing one, actually, for anybody working in nonprofits now. We have a unique relationship because we are a part of a public university, which should not be taken lightly. Like, this is amazing that these artists and this kind of programming get to come to students who are paying actually very little for their education. Hunter is very affordable compared to all of the other MFA programs in New York City. And it's also a great school. So Hunter, though, they support us by paying my salary by being, I'm a faculty at Hunter, and I teach the Artist Institute seminar, and I'm teaching another seminar now on making publications. But the rest of our funding comes from private donors, like philanthropists, like people in the art world that support many other places. And so we are a part of a public university, but I think people often get confused. They think that means Hunter pays for everything, but they don't. Although now they're paying for our rent uptown in the new basement. And so it's a question. I don't have an answer. I have some ideas about how I want to actually think really carefully about the fact that we are, in the possessive, the Artists Institute, and what that might mean for the demands that makes on who funds us and why and how. I think we need artists in another way, in fact, actually. Because some artists have done, I mean, I'm giving a little away, but some artists have done very well by the art market, and I would love for us to be those artists at the Artist Institute. And this is what else I'm thinking about, which is Carolee Schneemann, who's the next artist And I think we come at her practice at a really, I'm so excited to work with her now, because in thinking about who we have, how we make our choices, people ask that. And they should. And our stakes should actually be really clear. But at this moment, I think Carol Lee connects to many questions that we're dealing with about what is a body. Well, what does it mean to be embodied with people, to be present? And that probably relates to a lot of the ethos I hope you're getting from this talk about what the Artists Institute is. And I think Carol Lee is fantastic and really has had very, very little, we have very little opportunity to see her work actually in New York, where she's lived for the last 50 years. And I'm also thinking about publications, which is really exciting. The Artists Institute has, I mean, we have very particular kinds of pamphlets and materials and writing. The rhetoric around the Artists Institute has been very particular since it started with Anthony, and then now I've continued in thinking about the kind of tone or voice that we give to what we do that doesn't evoke the kind of distance that you might get at a professional contemporary arts institution. We don't need to do that. We know everyone, or I talk to every single person who comes through the door. And so thinking about publications seems like a necessity, because as I look at our program, it kind of makes sense to people, but kind of it does not make sense to people. And I'm hoping that in the format of a magazine, we might be able to make visual the fact that we are just as interested in what the object an artist make, their artwork, as we are in the artist as someone who produces knowledge of all kinds and has a really interesting, at least the artists we've worked with, research practice and set of concerns and a way of seeing the world that can be made visible, not just in a thing hanging on the wall or a sculpture sitting on the floor of the gallery. So Pierre will be the first, and that's why I have National Geographic, because this is like would be his magazine, you know, if he was a magazine. But then I have File, because I think this evokes the rough and tumble spirit of New York City and artists self-determining the way that they would be represented and using the magazine as a forum. And it's something that I'm thinking about. How could an institute or how could a curator think about a curator's magazine that's focused on an artist? In other words, how could we develop a language and a rhetoric and a visual that could give life to what it is that we do? So this is something else I'm thinking about now. And I think that I'd like to use the rest of the time actually talking to you all and getting your questions, even as specific and local as they might be, to like a very particular thing, it's okay. Because I really care a lot about institutions, I guess, and how we can make context for art that feel like it opens up something that we actually see and be with, as opposed to just like breeze by. So with that, the floor is yours.
Within the 6 months of each season, how often or how many events or programs do you have, and does that depend, like, is there a set number that you try to hit?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I should have actually visualized a season for you. So, and the structure has somewhat changed. The way it works now is that we have 6 months, let's just say typical, because like every artist is different. Pierre wanted to leave the same stuff in the gallery the whole time, and then things came in and out. But for Lucy, let's say, we did four times, we changed what was in there, and that enabled us to deal with the many sides of who she was. And in the case of Rosemary Trockel, to completely undo who you thought she was. Like every object we put in there undid who you thought Rosemary Trockel was. So maybe four times it'll change. And then within each of those four times that it's changing, we have a number of events which will relate specifically to the object in the room. I mean, associatively. Many things relate to objects, but the idea is that what we're putting with the thing or around the thing, if it's a speaker or a performance or an artwork, it's like it's directly relating back to the practice somehow, not just to our whims and fancies of what's cool. And in the new space, I'm hoping to have another modality of the archive, because I have a smaller room, so I think that'll be really important for Carolee. But it still can be, I mean, this, okay, criticism back to myself, and I don't know this is what you were even getting at, but even within the 6 months, we can do, like, sometimes so many events that can feel very tiring. So I'm trying to watch that, you know, because it's a demand on me and my time, but it's a demand on our audiences, because they love these artists. They want to be there. And so I think it's really important, actually, to say, like, guys, like, go home. You know, it's okay. You don't have to be here all the time. So I closed this fall to get ready for our move and to work on this publication. And some artist said to me, thank you. Because I kind of needed like a break from, not they like our program, but just saying, that's kind of nice actually to say, no, we need to not have something right now. So instead, once to fill a need, once a week, actually tonight, right now, people are at the Artist Institute for a once a week bar from 5 to 11, just Tuesday nights, very casual. The drinks are at cost. We have a time for artists. There's no art on the walls, and artists can just come there, people that we email, and just hang out, and the music's not too loud, and there's no opening you have to go to, and you don't have to network. And it's just been really nice. We've had, like, actual discussions about art. And, yeah. Yeah.
So one thing that you talked about was, like, the intentionality behind the very small space, like the smallness of scale in terms of that, and then the length or the largeness of time. And I wonder how the scale of economy in terms of the Artists Institute functions, like in terms of the budget for each season or overall.
Yeah. So I'm a no-growth person. I think it would be great. I'm for a no-growth economy. And actually, Dave Harvey is not very smart. So, no. So I think I've been thinking a lot about this. I think it's really important that our budget does not get so big. And I think that we need to pay artists nice fees, not just the anchor artists, but like every artist who does anything, even if they just give us a painting to hang on the wall for like 1 week, then they get an artist fee for that. So I'm thinking about what our budget needs to be based on paying people fairly. And what I know I need in terms of just from past seasons, like shipping stuff there, paying for an artist to come from out of town. I think that commissioning is like really interesting to me now, what that could mean. So if we grow at all, I could see raising some money so that an artist could make an artwork. And then I think once we get to a certain size of budget, then we don't do it anymore, and that's it. And the nice thing about Hunter is that there's not huge demands on me to like become huge. I don't think we're just like really small. So the staff is myself, and I've just hired an associate curator to work with me. We use freelance installers. Our yearly budget is excluding, I'm trying to like think, is it excluding salaries or not? I mean, each season, okay, aside from operating costs, salary, stuff like that, each season maybe is $50,000 or something, and that would include a lot of, yeah, so. Maybe our whole budget is $200,000 for everything, including rent and insurance and everything. So that's not huge. And but I just want to make sure, like, we're definitely on the edge always, you know? And I want us to feel like we're really good in terms of people being paid. That's important. this is my pitch for artists who might have $200,000, say. No, I'm serious, actually, because I think some artists out there could, like, easily sell a painting for, like, a lot more than $200,000, and guess what? A little painting could fund us for a whole year. And that's how I'm thinking now. We want to talk about performativity in painting. Like, let's let it be really performative, and it can fund us for a year. I think that kind of artists helping artists who have done well by the visions and dreams that we all have for their work, in fact, really means something. And, I mean, another thing in regards to funding that I've thought about is that the artists we work with are well-established artists. We've heard of these artists before. And so I don't think it's right either for us to have to ask younger artists in New York City to, say, become members of the Artists Institute, even for a little money, or to try to drum up money from people who are at a totally different place in their career than these artists. They don't need to be paying for the show of Pierre Wieck. Like, they don't. So that's another thing that I feel strongly about, too, given who our artists are.
So is that your idea, is that one of your ideas with the umbrella of private and public? If in fact the artist, the participants in this program could begin to give the program its lifeblood, like...
Oh, that's interesting. You mean like have, like... I mean, Lucy has actually made a donation to us, but no, I don't know that I like the idea of an artist like paying for their season. But I love the idea of like the most blue chip artists giving back actually to education and to younger artists who believe in their work. And to younger curators who give them value by writing, reviews of their shows in Art Forum. So I think there's a real kind of like thinking about the artist community and actually artist patronage in a way that we haven't fully thought about, because we're only now in a generation of artists who are capable of being patrons. This was not always the status of the artist, and the art world was not always like it is now with the way the market is.
Could you talk a little bit about what you were saying just before with the new location and kind of what you're, you know, hearkening back to?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, you know, when I thought about coming to New York from North Carolina... I thought about when Harry met Sally and how they're at that book signing party. And I thought about the Algonquin Hotel and how the New Yorker was founded and all these people were sitting around and they were talking about ideas. They were actually talking about ideas. And that's really what I wanted for myself. I think that's how a lot of people who live in New York City feel. And actually probably have people feel everywhere, actually. And so that's my vision for that townhouse. I want to show art there, but I want that art to be the occasion for really great gettings together of people who, some of whom we know from the art world, but maybe some of whom we know from the literary world or technology or all these other things that we're already doing in our program, because artists are people who think about lots of stuff. I would like to see our audience expand to a curious public of all stripes and backgrounds who can then get to know art through the thing that they do know, which might not be art, and then vice versa, that I think artists in New York would be, I mean, I had a dinner party recently where they were just so excited to meet Angelique or to meet this genetic engineer who can make rats with human eyeballs. that guy exists, and he spoke at the Artists Institute. So that to me is like an exciting thing. I'm not seeing myself or experiencing in the art world right now that I would love to be a part of making possible. And it's certainly for a small audience, but that's okay.
How much of your audience is beyond the university?
Actually, most of our audience. And what's really interesting is that over half our audience is beyond the United States. So I always say that we've been, although maybe we won't be now that we're going to be on the Upper East Side, a bit like an underground band. Like, people know about the Artists Institute, they hear about it. So the people who come are curators and artists from Europe and from out of town. We're like one of the stops. Or it's artists, that's our audience, or art professionals mostly, that come. Sometimes someone with a gallery guide comes, but not that much. and then the students are an audience that I want to grow. Our location is not great for students right now. Hunter College is at 68th and Lexington, which is uptown, and we're downtown at Eldridge and Delancey. So we just haven't been in proximity to the school. So we get the people that know about us from our seminar, their friends, some people, but I would love to see the university community embrace us, not just the art department. We're in the art department, and I get it, but I don't even see us being in the art department in many ways.
Yeah.
A lot of what you're talking about relates to me to some of the interdisciplinary artist organizations from the 70s and the 80s that became, that are like Where the Kitchen Came From in New York and White Columns in Houston, Diverse Works, Lace in LA.
Yeah.
And there's no good history of that. And a lot of the founding people may not be around anymore, but there's probably some dialogues that you can get about that might be interesting to me, because those organizations would have, video and music and dance and visual arts, and they would have people, connections with other people in their community, and it's very different than what you're trying to do, but it's related. And some of them would have publications like High Performance, was one from LA, and a bunch of different stuff. So, I mean, just a lot of what you're showing and talking about has resonance for me, because I worked with one of those organizations a long time ago in Seattle. But there is a lot of other ways. There are people who have done things like this that are great, and I hope you can continue doing this, because it sounds good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I love those places you mentioned. I mean, happy to be in their company. Yeah.
Do you, just to hit on what Herb's saying a little bit, I mean, that history, I mean, I know you know that you're not doing something particularly altogether new, but you're doing something that's responding to a need at a time. I mean, do you think that that's, I mean, I think, in fact, that's what you've said, that this grew out of that. That you looked, Anthony looked, when he was offered the possibility of doing something, he thought, what you're asking me is not what's needed, so I'm going to propose something else.
Right.
And now you've moved in, and it has your touch in that you're the one that's looking to see what's needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's such a beautiful model. It's like, it's what everybody, I mean,
we
what
we can't hear what she's saying at all.
Okay, I apologize. I'm just saying that I think that good grief. we're talking about here is not necessarily new in terms of, clearly there's a history of alternative kind of programming throughout ages. And I think that, but what I guess I don't even know how to form this question, but basically, what's the longevity, or what, you know, do you see there being any kind of resistance? Because it's just not so packageable, because if you're really going to truly be responsive, like if you're going to allow it to stay open enough that it informs itself, it defines itself as it moves forward. Mm-hmm. Like, how responsive do you think that you're going to find patrons and even your audience, like, to stay? Do you ever feel like that you're at risk because it doesn't look like what we're accustomed to? You can't wrap it up and present it kind of as this complete idea, because it's not a complete idea. It's an evolving idea, right?
Yeah. I mean, we intentionally don't use the professionalized lingo and way of doing stuff and being the way that people know how to know. Mm-hmm. Like, I know what that is. But I think that's our strength. And if it's our weakness, I guess that's just what happens, right? I think that some... I also really love the idea of organization, like a place like Orchard, you know, that lasted for 3 years. We're 3 years, we're out. I like that idea.
But they preset that, so they gave themselves an exit.
Yeah, there's a whole thing behind that decision. But no, I think that what grounds us too is like Hunter College. That's pretty exciting. Because I think something that's happening at Hunter, it's happening at many schools, is that they're really thinking about how does the curatorial fit into our program. We're an art history program. We're a master's of fine arts program. But we don't have any degree in curatorial studies. Do we need that? And so they're looking at their future being maybe a curatorial certificate program, and that the Artist Institute could be one piece of how someone could get acquainted with how you work with an artist. And I do care about our audience in New York, but I do think we do important work that needs to be even thought more about since we're getting closer to the school. But I'm not worried. I trust the process, and I do. I think we still need this right now, anyway.
See this need for intimacy in this country, you know, and because everything's moving so fast, and there's so much out there. Slowing down, taking the time to talk to a person face to face in a small room, focusing on one object, it's almost a lost art. And I can't see that as being a bad thing if you're a little satellite, for whatever reasons, ends in 3 or 4 years. It existed. And somewhere else, somebody else will pick it up. My thought is that maybe it'll hatch little eggs all the time.
Maybe. Some people have asked.
And then you would have other small colleges that don't have the huge budgets, but have the huge heart to share and educate, who's willing to take down that... vernacular that every organization has, no matter what, so that everyone understands what they're talking about, and share what art means to a community and culture and how we're all interconnected. Because if we don't, we're going to lose this wonderful connection in cultures. Because I think we're not going to be able to get it from the internet.
And we have to trust also that art's really good. You can like stand in front of something, I promise. You should do this here. You should like organize something in your galleries, have a little opening for a painting that only 15 people know about that the opening's happening. And you can just trust the art. I feel like we don't even trust the art anymore.
We have a program right now, and it feels like maybe it's sort of a best-kept secret, and it's called Slow Art Tour, and it happens once a month, and it's a very small group of people that come, not because only 15 are asked, but only a handful seem to be interested or to know about it, and... But it's with that in mind, and it's a docent-led, and I think the docents, a little bit like you're saying with the artists who have this experience, it's generative for them as well as them giving, you know, as we expect them to do. And I think the docents actually appreciate getting to think about one work of art in that way. And it's a 30-minute tour, and... So we haven't pushed it to an hour, and we haven't limited it to 15 people, but there's stuff out there like this, you know, and I think it kind of becomes our responsibility, too, to be looking for it. And then, you know, one of the reasons I wanted Jenny to come is because I feel like that things are really prime right now, and I know this will come and go, it's cyclical, but I feel like things are really prime right now for people wanting things, and I think... You know, it's good to be critical and to ask and to insist on things, but I think it's also critical that when something's not being provided for you to quietly make it happen. And, you know, I kind of feel like, I guess that's what I was getting to with my question, was like,
you know, I'm not worried about you. You clearly are going to go out and find something else that needs you and that you need to do. I mean, you know, so it's, and I think whoever was saying that, that's so true, that it's okay if this ends. It was so valuable, and that, you know, you can't work with the end in mind. You just have to keep going forward. But there is something like that. There's a slow art tour.
Hmm. Go to it. Oh, there's one there.
I think that what you have brought to Fort Worth has been very interesting. You have opened up a whole new line of whatever you want to call it, and it gives us a lot of food for thought, and we thank you for coming and sharing this with us.
Oh, that's beautiful.